Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's announcement Monday to help ease student loan debt with an executive order that expands Obama's pay-as-you-earn program. Jennifer Wang, who was at the White House signing, who is the policy and advocacy manager at the Young Invincibles, joins us. We will discuss how many of the indentured generation will get relief from this executive action and examine Senator Elizabeth Warren's bill that Obama endorsed, which allows student borrowers to refinance. Then we will speak with Rafia Zakaria, who is a columnist with Dawn, Pakistan's largest English language newspaper, about the brazen Taliban attack on the VIP section of Karachi's international airport, and her article at Al Jazeera, "Taliban's Rise in Karachi Must Be Stopped." We will discuss the escalating series of Taliban attacks in the huge port city and Prime Minister Sharif's stalled peace talks with the Taliban, as well as his efforts to attract foreign investment that is likely to be hurt by this latest terrorist attack. Then finally, we will look into the crash of a Walmart 18-wheeler truck driven by a company driver who dozed off and rear-ended a limo full of comedians, killing Jimmy Mack and severely injuring Tracy Morgan. The driver told police he had not slept for 24 hours. Liza Featherstone, a New York City-based journalist and author of Selling Women Short, The Landmark Battle for Workers' Rights at Walmart, joins us to assess whether this incident is another example of Walmart's exploitative attitude towards employees, who they prefer to call associates, in lieu of the fact that they don't pay a lot of their workers a living wage or cover health care, forcing many of them onto public assistance. And joining us now is Jennifer Wang, who is the Policy and Advocacy Manager at Young Invincibles, a national organization committed to mobilizing expanding opportunities for young Americans on issues such as higher education, healthcare, and jobs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Wang.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's great to be here.
And tell us about the White House signing today of this executive order to expand the already existing Obama program, Pay As You Earn.
You know, it was a really important step that the administration took for young people out there who are struggling with their student loan debt. We've got a $1.2 trillion student debt crisis that we know will persist unless the government acts now. And, you know, here at Young Invincibles, we hear from young people every day that they are really struggling to repay their debt. And President Obama's announcement of his executive action, we think, will really help lift the burden of student debt for as many as 5 million borrowers across the country.
So why is it then that I'm looking at various articles about this White House ceremony today, and, for example, CNN's Money headlining it, "Few Benefits from Obama's Student Loan Program." Few benefit, I should say. In other words, they're saying that not too many people are going to be benefiting from this. So why the disconnect between the 5 million? That 5 million is a substantial number, isn't it?
5 million is a very substantial number. And just to put this into perspective, you know, we heard from a young man today, Andy McCracken, who was actually the person to introduce President Obama today at the White House. And he shared his story with us. He said that his monthly payments under standard student loan repayment would have been almost $900 a month. But under Pay As You Earn, which is what the president is expanding for this 5 million, for these 5 million borrowers, you know, he would be only paying roughly $200 a month. And, you know, for a young person just starting out in their career, almost $700 a month is extremely substantial. And for Andy, he actually shared with us that it's the difference between having to move back home with his parents in Colorado and being able to be out on his own. So I think for the 5 million borrowers out there that this is about to help, I think that this is that it has the potential to be very impactful. And again, I think it's a very important step for them.
But so far, how many people have enrolled in this program? And this, of course, is in the context of the fact that there are 40 million with student loan debt nationwide. And I believe student loan debt is now considerably more than credit card debt in this country, is it not?
Certainly, you know, our generation, the millennial generation, graduated from college into the worst economy since the Great Depression, and we're all feeling its ripple effects. You know, I think that young people are certainly doing the right thing. They're going to college. Many of them have to take out student debt to do that. But, you know, we know that a college degree is certainly worth it. You know, a young person who has a college degree will earn double in their lifetime than a young person who only has a high school diploma. So, you know, in terms of people who are enrolling, you know, the student loan repayment plans, there are several of them. The whole system is very confusing. We hear from young people all the time that, you know, they wish they knew about income-based repayment or pay-as-you-earn, which was the policy that President Obama expanded today. And there's a lot of confusion in navigating these student loans. And so, you know, we hear from young people that it's a policy they wish they knew about when they started to repay their loans. And it's a policy that we think will actually help drive down the number of people who default on their student debt because it makes repayment all the more manageable.
And how does this relate to the fact that the U.S. government is not only in the student borrowing business, a lot of it goes through fronts that drive up the prices. And we can, if you like, talk about the incredible racket of the for-profit colleges that get minority students and vets involved in paying enormous student loans and borrowing enormous student loans and ending up with worthless diplomas. But just in terms of the picture of the traditional student loans, isn't the government also in the business of collecting loans, and they make money out of these loans?
That's exactly right, which is why I think at Young Invincibles we believe that it's definitely time to invest in, you know, the population and to invest in our generation, because we know that it's certainly a worthwhile investment. You know, like I said, you know, we've got you know, the issue of young people graduating from college really having a much easier time in today's economy than people with a high school diploma. But there's still a lot of widespread, you know, severely high young adult unemployment in the generation. And without investments in our education, without investments in our future, it's going to be very difficult for our generation, and we will continue to struggle. But, you know, I think that there's examples of that investment out there. You know, we saw Senator Mary Landrieu introduce a bill that would nearly double Pell Grants, and we know that Pell Grants are absolutely essential for young, low-income and some middle-income students and families to put themselves through college. And it's, you know, that there's certainly a variety of reforms out there that we can look to for that investment.
Again, I'm speaking with Jennifer Wang, who's the Policy and Advocacy Manager at Young Invincibles, a national organization committed to mobilizing and expanding opportunities for young Americans on issues such as higher education, healthcare, and jobs. So in terms of the pay-as-you-earn program, which the president signed executive order today, opening it up to more, 2 million apparently have signed up so far, and now there's opportunity for another 5 million to join the program, and in the context of the 40 million with student debt. What does it mean, though, pay as you earn? In other words, it means that you can spread the payments out later as you get a job. Is that, give me a sense of the mechanics of this.
Absolutely. So pay as you earn, which is, you know, President Obama's policy that he expanded today, would allow people with student loan debt to pay back their monthly student loan payments at 10% of their income. And that would mean that you would be paying back your loans according to how much you're actually earning. So for some young people who went to college and are still unemployed or are still looking for a job, you know, under pay as you earn, if they're not earning any income and they're really struggling to get by, it would absolutely be a relief for those borrowers. And, you know, as a young person, you know, move through their career and starts to earn more money, they would pay more, but it would be capped at 10% of their income. And it would also allow student loan borrowers who really struggle for a number of years to have their debt forgiven if after 2 decades they're still paying down their debt.
So, Jennifer Wang, at the White House today, where you were at this ceremony, the president also endorsed Senator Elizabeth Warren's bill that would allow borrowers to refinance their student loans, including those issued by private banks. And this program would be paid for by the so-called Buffett rule, which would raise taxes on millionaires. And President Obama said in the White House today, quoting, lower tax bills for millionaires or lower student loan bills for the middle class. This should be a no-brainer. So you can't help but agree with that, but where's the bill going? What's going to happen to this bill? The House of Representatives are not likely to even look at it, right?
You know, you're absolutely right. It certainly does seem like a no-brainer. I mean, it's, you know, a great irony that young people today have seen their parents and their families refinance their mortgages, but our generation isn't able to refinance their student loan debt, and we're certainly being saddled with more and more. You know, I certainly think that young people are paying attention. You know, student loan debt is an issue that really drives people to the polls, and many of the polls that we've seen recently really say that young people absolutely care about this issue and that they'll vote with it. So, you know, I think that people realize that our generation is paying attention, and I think that we're looking for an issue that we consider to be a no-brainer, that we consider to be a very logical issue, and we feel that Senator Warren's bill is just that, you know, expanding giving relief to existing borrowers, the 40 million of them, is certainly a priority, particularly for the ones who are struggling with high payments.
So, Jennifer Wang, in this midterm election, where the president's already on a couple of occasions castigated Democrats for not showing up at the polls in midterms and even going so far as to say that Democrats have a genetic problem. They show up for presidential elections but not for midterms. And in this primary that just took place, even here in California, which is a very blue state, Republicans showed up in greater numbers and Democrats less so, although quite often there were more Democratic candidates running. But it certainly, if that's a harbinger for November, it would indicate that the turnout for the Democrats is going to be low. Is there any indication from your generation and the work that you do at Young Invincibles that the students who are very much affected, being this indentured generation for the first time in history, where the student loan bill is so extraordinary, where it's so high in this country that it's greater than household debt, as far as I know, and certainly twice that of credit card debt, what is the chances then of this being a motivating issue?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, student debt, we know, is a core economic issue for a growing number of people, particularly those in our generation, the millennial generation, 18 to 34. And it's absolutely, I think, going to be a motivating factor behind driving young people to the polls, because we've seen polling that, you know, voters really do consider it an important issue. You know, it's a pocketbook issue for our generation. And I think that young voters will be aware of who's delivering on their promises to the generation. You know, like I said, we've got 40 million people out there with student loan debt. That's a huge voting block. And, you know, Elizabeth Warren's bill would provide immediate relief to a substantial portion of that 40 million. And when it's as real, like I said, you know, our story here today, Andy McCracken, when it's as real as a huge difference between your payments, you know, I think that student debt can really be a motivating factor.
And in terms of whether or not the students show up in the midterms in November, what about the other argument that economists put forth, and that is that the $1 trillion in outstanding student loan debt – is burdening the economy. It curtails graduates' ability to buy cars, assuming they graduate, take out mortgages, you know, buy refrigerators, toasters, you name it. Because the average student who graduates today has an outstanding debt of $29,400.
Absolutely, and you're completely right in framing it as an economic issue that affects all of us, because we at Young Invincibles hear from young people day to day about how their student debt is becoming an economic burden for them. You know, young people are not buying cars the way they used to. They're unable to buy homes the way that they used to. And, you know, some of them have even told us that they have delayed starting a family or getting married because they feel as if they'll never be able to afford to do so. And it used to be the issue of young people who went to college and had some student loan debt actually bought homes at higher rates. But, you know, now we see a shift in that. We see that young people with student loan debt are being blocked from being able to buy homes because there's just so much more debt. And so you're absolutely right. It's an issue that it will affect all of us. And it's an issue that is having a big effect on the economy. The New York Fed recently released a report, I think it was last year, on how much student loan debt is having an effect on the general economy at large.
So in terms of Elizabeth Warren's bill, which would allow about 25 million Americans to refinance federal and private loans at lower interest rates, apparently the legislation is going to cost the government $58 billion over 10 years, but they plan to raise $72 billion through this new tax on high-income earners on Wall Street, the so-called Buffett rule, which that the Republicans have been fighting tooth and nail against since it was first introduced. Senator Schumer is saying that this the president's executive action would be a backstop to if the bill does not make it through the Senate and the Republican-controlled House. Well, I don't know what the if is about. It surely is not going to make it through the House because nothing makes it through the House. I mean, we have gridlock. Nothing. This is the do-nothing House. They are, you know, almost psychotically opposed to Obama. They have many of them have what's referred to as the Obama derangement syndrome.
You know, I think that the numbers really have to speak for themselves. You know, we're at the point now where more than one in seven student loan borrowers are defaulting in their debt within 3 years of graduating. And I think that what I mentioned before about how severe of an economic impact student loan debt is having on the economy, you know, I really do think that at some point folks are going to have to really pay attention to their constituents, because the 40 million people out there with student debt are certainly concerned. Many of them are struggling. And I think, like I said, as far as young people, you know, we are certainly watching to see anyone. I mean, I think anyone in Congress, you know, whether they're delivering on their promises to our generation. So I certainly hope that everyone starts to take notice about how large this issue really is for all of us, not just the generation or the millennial generation, but for all of us.
Well, the students do have parents, and the parents have they certainly have a stake in this, don't they? Because the student that you talked about earlier, who spoke at the White House today, you know, the prospect of moving back home with the folks is not exactly a win-win for either side, is it?
Sure. I mean, you know, there's new information out there. I think I've heard that young people, a third of the young people in our generation, are moving back home with their parents. And many of these parents actually took on debt themselves to finance the educations of their children. And it's, I think, an issue that really is spanning many generations. You know, a portion of the 40 million existing borrowers are out there are older. And, you know, we hear the story all the time of, a parent, you know, trying to pay down their own student debt while trying to save for the you know, college of their own children. And it's a multi-generational issue. And like I said, I really do think that it's beginning to affect all of us.
Well, Jennifer Wang, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much. It was great to be on.
Again, I've been speaking with Jennifer Wang, who's the Policy and Advocacy Manager at Young Invincibles, a national organization committed to mobilizing and expanding opportunities for young Americans on issues such as higher education, health care, and jobs. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the Pakistan Taliban attack on the Karachi airport. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Rafia Zakaya, who is a columnist for Dawn, Pakistan's largest English newspaper. Her forthcoming book is The Upstairs Wife, An Intimate History of Pakistan. And she has an article at Al Jazeera, Taliban's Rise in Karachi Must Be Stopped. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rafia Zakaya.
Thank you for having me.
And your piece at Al Jazeera, The Taliban Rise in Karachi Must Be Stopped, is quite shocking when you add up all of the attacks. They have been escalating. And, of course, this latest attack on the VIP section at Karachi's International Airport, I assume it's going to be a big blow, given that the city's not just an important port city, but also a financial center. And I take it that Prime Minister Sharif, who's peace talks with the Taliban are stalled, has also tried to attract foreign investment, has he not?
He has, and that is one of the platforms on which his government was elected, was to increase foreign investment in Pakistan. And you're also correct about Karachi's position within Pakistan. It is a country's financial hub. It produces 70% of Pakistan's gross domestic product. Jinnah International Airport, which was the target of these assailants who attacked yesterday, is the country's largest international airport, the hub for many international flights coming in and out of Karachi. I've obviously traveled in and out of there many, many times. And it's a tremendous blow symbolically as well, because it represents the fact that this group, the Tehreek-e Taliban Pakistan, who have taken responsibility for the attack, are now able to cut off Karachi and, by definition, Pakistan from the rest of the world in this very drastic and dramatic way. The fire is still burning in one part of the airport. Now it's, I believe, 27 hours since the attack happened. Pakistani television is still reporting at least 6 to 7 people who are still missing, who are presumed to be inside the still burning section of the cargo area of the airport. So, it's a very dark day, and it's something that, of course, has, as the article that I wrote pointed out, something that was seen coming for a while now, and no one seems to have been able to stop it. U.S. strategy has focused on the elimination of individual Taliban and Al-Qaeda leaders via drone attacks. What you're seeing in Karachi is that all that the drone attacks have done is led to a tactical change on the part of off the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, where they've basically now located to a very densely populated area where you know they can be targeted by drones, and where there are literally millions of people that are caught in the middle of this war between the U.S. And the Taliban.
And I take it that they're lucky to have sanctuary, the Taliban, Pakistan Taliban, well, I mean, in the large Pashtun neighborhoods of Karachi,
right,
which
precisely.
Are essentially you can't, the police basically can't enter or don't enter. Is that what, that's what your article indicated?
Right, that's exactly right. I mean, what you've got is these informal, I mean, they're essentially slums that are located on the outskirts of Karachi. There has always been a traditional, you know, Pashtun immigrant population in the city, starting from when the, you know, the first Afghan war and the 80s when people moved to those areas. And now through those kinship networks, you've got more refugees moving in from the northwest, you know, from Khyber Pakhtunkhwa and the tribal areas into those parts of the city. And it's very difficult for law enforcement to penetrate those areas. It's very difficult, for them to... And those fights have been going on. I mean, there's actually operations going on in those areas literally, I mean, every day, every week in Karachi. But they've been unable to flesh this out. I mean, you know, it's a huge city. It's reported now to be between 18 and 20 million people with very, very little infrastructure. And so, you know, I mean, even yesterday's attack right now, I mean, one of the sort of headline stories in Pakistan is how the, you know, the military was able to clear the main terminal and, you know, get that going again. But the fire is in the cargo terminal, and it's the city that's responsible for putting out the fire. But the fire trucks that are coming in don't have the right equipment to put out that fire. So, you know, you've got problems like that that happen again and again. And it's also because, I mean, terrorism is a huge issue, and extremists like the Taliban, you know, are able to take very few resources and endanger the lives of thousands of civilians. And when it's difficult, you know, in a country like the U.S. to protect people, then just imagine, you know, what it's like for a country like Pakistan with absolute a fraction of the resources available in the U.S. to try to protect its citizens. So you know, I mean, it's a combination of a lot of these factors that is leading to what is happening there right now. But I think, you know, for American listeners, the worst thing is that, you know, you've got a war that was in one country, and then in a neighboring province in Pakistan that is now spread to the biggest city in Pakistan. So for the Taliban, it's a huge victory, the fact that they can even conduct these operations. And it should definitely give, you know, Americans some, you know, the basis for doubting what they've been fed in terms of the war on terror, the success of drone attacks, and all of the sort of very unquestioned rhetoric that dominates the American perspective of what's going on in that region.
And again, I'm speaking with Rafia Zakaria, who is a columnist for Dawn, Pakistan's largest English newspaper. Her forthcoming book is The Upstairs Wife, An Intimate History of Pakistan. And she has an article at Al Jazeera, Taliban's Rise in Karachi Must Be Stopped. You also point out that 73% of terrorists who are arrested are acquitted because of lack of evidence, because witnesses are scared off, and that you're calling for a kind of Pakistan version of witness protection. I take it that's a part of a long list of what's needed, because a senior police official was attacked, police vehicles have been attacked, a television news van was attacked, and also Sufi shrines have been attacked as well in a very brutal way. That's another question I have for you, because I know that all the Sufis were driven out of the Swat Valley as well. What is it about the Taliban that goes after the Sufis first?
Well, the sort of details of this war are the fact that the Taliban belong to the Deobandi sect of Sunni Islam, which believes that Sufism and some of its tenets of intercession are essentially heresy. And so for the listeners that don't know, Sufi Islam has a very long historic tradition in the subcontinent of Sufi mysticism, Sufi shrines. People visit them, they pray at them, and it's been very much a part of our traditional South Asian culture, our traditional South Asian means of practicing Islam. And the Taliban are against that, and so they've made it a point to attack Sufi shrines repeatedly, including, the one that was attacked in January, in which the six people were beheaded and decapitated and left there with a note from the Taliban. So the attack is on from many different sides. And I think the issue becomes that, you talked about the rate of acquittal. The rate of acquittal is, you're precisely right. Witnesses are scared. Plus, the justice system of Pakistan is broken. And the way to help that. So, you've got the U.S.-Pakistan relationship that is essentially based on, predominantly military aid. So it doesn't help the civilian institutions like the justice system essentially develop mechanisms that can actually convict these terrorists, that can put them in prison. More importantly, the shadow of American imperialism obscures the reality from ordinary Pakistanis, so that they, instead of focusing on how they can themselves fight extremism, they're focused on American meddling into their country, which is a very real issue. So, the point is that until the U.S. completely withdraws from that region, until it stops conducting secret CIA operations, until it stops drone attacks, Pakistanis themselves are not going to be able to contend with the true cost of extremism in their own society. The fact is that only Pakistanis can defeat this sort of obscurantist, nihilistic philosophy of the Taliban. And many of them do. But they're caught in an impossible situation right now, where they are essentially, caught in the crossfire between, they see themselves as caught in the crossfire between the United States and the Taliban. And they're the ones who are dying. Pakistan is the world's number one victim of terrorism. It has the highest number of terrorist attacks than anywhere in the world. There have been over 400 of them just this year. So, I think it's time for the world to see just how crushed ordinary Pakistanis are under this weight. And Americans particularly are complicit in this. It is in their name that this war is being carried out. And, if you're someone in Pakistan, the way you would see it is to say, okay, this is an American projection of power. They want to keep fighting this war here because it makes them believe that somehow it makes Americans safer. Well, there's absolutely no connection, to that. And the true tragedy is that this sort of strategy where individual targets, whether it's Osama bin Laden or Hakim al-Masood or whoever else, exterminating them, while it might be a good symbolic gesture, it hasn't really been shown to reduce the power of these groups to conduct these attacks. At least from the Pakistani perspective, you see them getting stronger and stronger. Here they were just in the tribal areas. From there, they expanded into, the populated areas of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. Then they went into Balochistan. Now they're in Karachi, and they are attacking and shutting down the heart of the country. So the evidence is out there, but the questions, at least from the American side, are simply not being asked.
Well, if this was an example of American imperialism going into Afghanistan, then it's been a total failure. And my understanding is that this was mostly to revenge the attack on 9/11. That's why the U.S. went in there, and they quickly crushed the Taliban. And the Taliban, of course, are in many ways a creation of either the Pakistani military or the ISI. And as far as I can tell, the U.S. is trying to get out of there. So whatever the projections of power and imperialism were in the minds perhaps of people like Dick Cheney and George W. Bush, it's very difficult to see what exactly they were after in terms of imperial gains. It's been a complete waste of lives and treasure. It's true that the collateral damage has largely been Pakistan has endured, but the U.S. is getting out. So what's your suggestion then in terms of what the U.S. should do short of getting out, which is what they're doing?
Well, the U.S. is not getting out. I mean, the fact is that the section of the war that you don't hear about, I mean, you're talking about obviously a U.S. troop withdrawal, but the war that's going on in Pakistan, the American presence there is all controlled by the CIA. The drone attacks that are conducted in Pakistan, as well as the targeted raids that are conducted in Pakistan,
but with the permission of the Pakistan military. There's no way that the CIA...
Well, no. I mean, nobody knows that, right? Well, nobody knows that. And in that sense, that's actually a great point, because this is precisely what I mean, is that when the U.S. wants to accomplish a strategic goal, they work with the Pakistani military. What that essentially does is make the Pakistani government, the civilian elected representative government of Pakistan, look like an idiot, because the U.S. is not negotiating with them. They're just negotiating with the military because they want to accomplish their military objectives. So if you're going to talk about what happens to the people of Pakistan, you have to work with the people that those people elect, which is not the Pakistani military. Now, the U.S. has never done that. It will never do that because it's a much more difficult thing to do. It's far easier to give the Pakistani military whatever it wants, and to try to get your strategic victories in exchange for that. And that's what's happening right now. So when you talk about the shadow of imperialism, that's the shadow of imperialism, is that if you're an ordinary Pakistani and you've got already a very strong military, but then you also have the world's largest superpower supporting that military, then your chances of having a representative government that's in any way accountable, that actually cares about all these civilians dying, are next to nil. And that involvement is not going to end, even after the withdrawal in Afghanistan. And the reason for that you didn't mention is basically the strategic location of Pakistan. You've got a country that has, sadly, the misfortune of being located next to, Russia, India, and China. Those are three of our immediate, neighbors in our neighborhood. And you've got the American presence in Afghanistan. That's the reason why the conflict is happening there, because there's a convergence of emerging superpowers as well as existing superpowers in that location. However, for the people who live there and who cannot leave, that has become a hell, because it's all these proxy wars that are being fought in that terrain. I mean, just look at this war in Afghanistan. Pakistan has been the supply route for U.S. NATO supplies. It's gone down from Karachi through the whole country, across the border into Afghanistan, because Afghanistan is landlocked. Now, can you imagine what happens? If California became the conduit for weapons between two other countries, Canada and Mexico. There would be a huge black market in military equipment emerging all around those communities, and all those communities on that way would be endangered. Basically, what I'm saying is that would never be allowed in the Western industrialized world, in the United States, in Canada, in Europe. But that's what's been happening in Pakistan. You've got people whose backyards have become part of a military supply route, which has endangered people all along those routes. You know, I've been in Karachi again and again and again when NATO supply convoys are attacked. So these are the costs of war, and people in other countries, people in Pakistan are seeing them and they're paying for them every day. You know, and Americans, because, you know, they are at a distance, because they don't have to pay attention to this war, because war has essentially been subcontracted now to the Department of Defense, to the CIA, they don't have to be bothered with it. But, you know, people are on the other side of the world paying for that. Even if Americans choose not to see that or listen to that or pay attention to it.
Well, Rafia Zakaia, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Rafia Zakaia, who is a columnist for Dawn, Pakistan's largest English newspaper. Her forthcoming book is The Upstairs Wife, An Intimate History of Pakistan, and she has an article at Al Jazeera, Taliban's Rise in Karachi Must Be Stopped. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the driver for Walmart who dozed off because he hadn't slept for 24 hours. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Liza Featherstone, who's a New York City-based journalist who has written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, Newsday, Columbia Journalism Review, Salon, and Slate, among others. She is the author of Selling Women Short, The Landmark Battle for Women's Workers' Rights at Walmart. Welcome to Background Briefing, Liza Featherstone.
It's a pleasure. Nice to be here.
And the driver of the 18-wheeler that crashed into the back of the limousine carrying a group of comedians, one of whom died, and of course the more prominently known one, Tracy Morgan, is in critical condition. He apparently dozed off on the turnpike and woke up just as in time to swerve, but he hit the limo full on with a huge impact of that big vehicle, and there was a concertina of other cars involved in the crash. And apparently he told police that he had not slept for 24 hours, and in the complaint filed by the district attorney for a hearing that will take place on Wednesday, the complaint says that Roper, the driver of the truck, hadn't slept in excess of 24 hours. So now, of course, Walmart are now saying, a Walmart spokesman issued a news release that said that with regards to news reports that suggest Mr. Roper was working for 24 hours, it is our belief that Mr. Roper was operating within the federal hours of service regulations, which, of course, refer to limits of 11-hour driving in a 14-hour period followed by 10 hours of rest. So the math just doesn't work. Having spent a lot of time at Walmart interviewing their employees and writing a book about workers at Walmart, who do you believe at this point, the district attorney or the Walmart spokesman?
Well, you're absolutely right. It certainly doesn't add up. Both of those stories can't be true. He can't have been up for 24 hours, and he can't have been in compliance with the federal regulations. And it would not be surprising to me if the driver story was true and if Walmart was lying, because Walmart does routinely violate violate federal laws protecting worker safety. And in this case, of course, it's not only the worker safety that was at stake, but the public. There was a particular onus on the company to follow the rules with truck drivers, because a crash involving a truck driver, as we can see, can affect quite a few people.
So what is your sense then of obviously we don't know, and perhaps we'll learn more on Wednesday, but assuming that the police and the district attorney are correct in this, and that the driver admitted that he hadn't slept for 24 hours, would that indicate that he was under any pressure to perform? Because that's my antenna that went up was, well, why would the guy be driving for such long hours unless he was under some pressure from his boss to deliver?
Yeah, well, to tell you the truth, I mean, before the reports came out that the driver said he hadn't slept for 24 hours, when I first saw the story, I thought, I wonder how long that guy has been on the road. Because we've certainly been hearing, those of us who follow Walmart have been hearing these stories about conditions for truck drivers for quite some time, and they certainly are pressured to perform. They certainly are pressured to make their deliveries in an unrealistic amount of time. I mean, in the same way that employees throughout Walmart's supply chain are pressured beyond how humans should be pressured. I mean, you see Walmart putting pricing pressure on factories in China to get the garments a certain number of garments made just in time, and you see horrendous pressures and safety issues resulting from that. And then you see in the stores, you often see far too few employees on the floor, so that Walmart can save money. And
by the way, you're not talking about employees; you're talking about associates.
Sorry, associates. Yes, this is. Walmart employees are all called associates, which is sort of a remnant of a time when the language of the company was deliberately chosen to make employees feel more enthusiastic and more part of the company.
So, in other words, they promoted them with a lofty title, as though they were sort of semi-management, but forgot to pay them.
Yeah,
accordingly.
And actually that's common. I mean, I talk to many quote unquote department managers who are actually hourly workers. They're not paid better than other hourly workers. They don't have the power to hire and fire other workers. They don't do any of the things that most of us think managers do, but they're called department managers in this very condescending effort to make them feel more important. So that's really typical for Walmart to do, but more seriously are the issues that we've been discussing, where in order to wring the maximum profit out of these people, Walmart will really work them far beyond what's reasonable and often far beyond what's legal which is why I would not be surprised if this driver in the Tracy Morgan crash was telling the truth.
Again, I'm speaking with Eliza Featherstone. She's a New York City-based journalist who has written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, Newsday, Columbia Journalism Review, Salon, and Slate, among others. She's the author of Selling Women Short, The Landmark Battle for Workers' Rights at Walmart. So in your book, you point out that there's this sort of disconnect that Walmart is both the icon of American free enterprise and self-sufficiency and also one of the biggest welfare queens of our time. What I find extraordinary is that the heirs, Sam Walton's heirs, the founder's heirs, together, the family, their combined wealth is equal to that of the lower 40% of all American households, that mm-hmm. these people are just literally piling up billions and billions and billions that they can't possibly spend. They don't seem to have any great humanitarian or altruistic bent, except for they spend money on lobbying for charter schools. So I'm just astounded why it is that the heirs just keep piling up billions and billions. They simply can't spend. At the same time, they don't want their workers to have a living wage and have health care, et cetera. Did you ever get to the bottom of that disconnect?
Well, I mean, our system encourages that, really. I mean, it encourages rich people with a large amount of stock in companies to get as much money as they possibly can and to get the most out of the people who are doing the real work. That's unfortunately the reality, which is why I think we need a better system. I think that there are certainly other countries that do a much better job of at least somewhat regulating that kind of greed that we've seen just running rampant with the Walton families and the Walton family, and that has served them and only them really so well, and has really done a great disservice to the millions of people who they've employed, and also many, many more Americans who have also been wronged by this, because it's a labor model that sets the tone for other parts of the economy. I mean, if you work for a retail business and your employer competes with Walmart, your wages are going to be affected. Race to the bottom is kind of a cliche, but it is a race to the bottom in some of those situations. If you used to work in manufacturing, one of the reasons that you perhaps don't anymore is due to price pressure from companies like Walmart that want to sell things as cheaply as possible, and have moved that overseas or moved it to parts of the less regulated U.S. economy. So you have to. I mean, the ripple effects are tremendous throughout. If you're only option is Walmart, you're going to demand far less from your other employers, from your other potential employers. So it affects people who work in other industries as well. You know, if you live in a town where there's a Walmart and a few other businesses, Walmart is helping to set your wages there as well. So it really has had a tremendous effect beyond just Walmart itself. And you know, we can't, we can't just blame Walmart and the Waltons for it. I mean, it's not that they're uniquely greedy people. It's that our system does not have a way to keep such greed in check. I mean, we have just uncritically for decades promoted this idea that that capitalists are good and whatever they want is good for the rest of us, and you know that a rising tide will lift all boats, and we've just seen that that's not always the case, and you know that you know we really need structures in place that ensure fairness for workers and for everybody else in the economy.
But Liza Featherstone, when you talk about Walmart being the biggest welfare queen, that's a reference to the fact that so many of their workers don't get paid a living wage and have to turn to food stamps and Medicare and other
that's
federal
right.
programs. But
that's right, because they're simply not paid adequately by Walmart, and sometimes
that means you and I have to pick up the tab, the rest of it, right?
We do indeed, even if our wages are not actually being
right. But then you compare
by Walmart, then our
what happened there?
Our taxes,
right? Yeah. But the point I wanted to make was vis-a-vis you were talking about the capitalist system. What about GM, Ford, IBM, all of the big American corporations, the Fortune 500? As far as I know, they don't screw their workers to death. They pay them a living wage and mm-hmm. health care benefits and pensions, and which, of course, are all being downsized, but they nevertheless. So
right.
isn't there – I mean, how much are Walmart the outliers where they're creating this race to the bottom? Because I know that Sears is going out of business, and maybe Sears will decide, well, the only way to stay in business is to pay our workers slave wages and don't cover their health care and et cetera.
To some extent, they're creating this race to the bottom, but to some extent, they're also really benefiting from it because workers don't have – we have very weak labor laws. It's very difficult for the workers to unionize, so in a lot of ways, Walmart is just benefiting from a system that has only gotten more unfriendly to the worker and more friendly for the boss over the last couple decades. And the companies that you mentioned, I mean, as you acknowledge, are going away. I mean, those industries are, the number of people employed in the auto industry is just constantly shrinking. You know, so so we're seeing that those kinds of businesses where so many workers were part of unions, did make middle-class wages, could support their families, those kinds of jobs are going away. So I would not say that, I think, you know, Walmart are particularly aggressive in this race to the bottom, and they've been mm-hmm. particularly, they've been industry leaders, to borrow a term from economics.
Right.
They've been industry leaders that set the tone,
right.
But they're really benefiting from our particular form of neoliberalism.
Well, Liza Featherstone, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Liza Featherstone, who's a New York City-based journalist, and she's the author of Selling Women Short, The Landmark Battle for Workers' Rights at Walmart. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.